What is up? It is me, George G. We've got another awesome episode of the Aligned Money Show coming your way featuring Tom Wall. Tom is a PhD. He is one of the foremost experts in designing retirement income and whole life insurance. He is the creator and host of the Fast Start Forum, the founder and CEO of Whole Life Masterminds. He is a best-selling author, speaker, and consultant and coach. We had a great conversation that, of course, started with two truths and a lie. And then we focused most of our time today on using whole life in retirement income and went through a lot of inside baseball into how these products actually work, a lot of the misconceptions about whole life insurance, some of the really positive aspects, some of the things to be careful of, and sort of a primer for just how to better understand it, who it's a good fit for, who should avoid it. I think we had a very sober conversation that hopefully you will find immensely valuable, but I guess that you will be the judge of that. Let's go. Tom, to get us started, give me two truths and a lie, please.
Well, two truths and a lie. Well, since college, I have moved 12 different times. I have visited all 50 states, and I founded a successful internet company in 1999 and was part of the dot-com washout.
Moved 12 times. That's quite a few. You have been to every state, all 50 of them, and you founded an internet company in 1999. Let's see, in 1999, Tom, I think I'm older than you are, and that would put me in college, so maybe you in high school. I'm going to say that you've not been to all 50 states.
Very good. Yes, only 45.
Tell me about the internet company.
Yeah, so when I was actually a senior in high school, and a friend, it was at the time when, you know, the internet was just getting started, and a friend of mine and I said, you know, hey, you know, we see these like chain mail emails. Remember when email was still kind of a new thing? And we said, what if we stole some JavaScript and created like a Mad Lib style page and did it around Valentine's Day and sent it out to all of our friends and told them that they would have bad luck if they didn't send it to their friends. And next thing I know, for 1 month, I was the 17th most visited website on the internet.
Wow.
with something like 4 million page views, which quickly went away. But it was actually it was the start of a little company that, you know, in today's world doesn't sound like a lot of money. But back then, as a 17-year-old kid, I was killing it. So and then everything changed when college hit and the dot-com bubble happened and advertisers were paying, you know, 1/20th of what they were before. And, you know, I made the decision to face the real world, but it was quite the experience. Probably beginning of my entrepreneurial career right there.
I think that certainly makes sense. Do you know which states you've not been to?
Yes. I have not been to Alaska, Hawaii, North Dakota, Nebraska, and I believe Oklahoma.
Okay.
Although I may have passed through.
I would have guessed that you'd been to Hawaii, but I was wondering about Alaska for sure. So
we'll get there. It's on the list. Maybe next year.
Maybe next year. Is North Dakota on the list too, Tom?
We'll find out. You know, I'm open to travel wherever. I'm in a different city every week, so it's only a matter of time.
It's a good point. It's a good point. The good folks in North Dakota and Oklahoma and the other places deserve to hear what you have to say. So all right. Well, what is top of mind for you right now?
Great question. You know, I've been blown away with all the work that I've been doing, traveling around, how much the topic of retirement income planning is resonating with people. And it's not about wealth creation. It's really about how do we spend it? I think that's a lot of folks don't even know that it's an issue. But once they start to, you know, get their mind around how they actually spend the money in that volatile, taxable, big account called their 401k, their eyes, you know, get really, really wide in terms of, wow, I never thought about how it comes out. And it's a scary proposition. So it's been top of mind. It's really what I've built my whole career around. And the message just is really resonating with advisors and clients alike. So that's kind of what I've been up to.
Just saw Tom Hegna posted some research that came out, and people that have more guaranteed income saved or were able to spend more than like 44% more than people without guaranteed income. And the whole idea was that we spend an entire lifetime saving all this money. Why would I feel comfortable all of a sudden just spending it?
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you think about it. It's if you have a stable, you know, W-2 career, you know, every Friday that those thousands of dollars hit your checking account and they're all gone by the next day after you pay off your credit cards and make your mortgage payments and go shopping. And really, you don't care because in 2 weeks, it's going to happen again and again and again and again. So as long as you're secure in your career, all good. And that's so different for retirees that haven't built that guaranteed income stream. You know, they're not sure what's going to happen to that nest egg that's supporting it all. So very prudently, I say they end up hoarding their wealth because they just don't know. And the risk is all on them. It's not spread, you know, across a group of people like a traditional pension would be. And that's the issue.
So Tom Hegna, he approaches this from an annuity standpoint, and you are one of the leading experts in whole life insurance. So how does that, that's kind of a big question to ask. How did you come to get so focused on that? Maybe we'll start there.
You know, truthfully, the reason I got so focused on whole life insurance is I began my career 23 years ago, getting licensed to sell it and then becoming, you know, a salesperson of it. And then quickly in my career evolved into a role where I was actually supporting, you know, thousands of advisors and eventually tens of thousands of advisors across the country in the sale of that, talking about how you position it and how you integrate it into a plan. And I wouldn't say it's at odds at all with Tom's message. In fact, it's very supportive. What I kind of got to very early in my career is I realized it was a very early client interaction that I had. It must have been in my first year, meeting with somebody who in the year 2004 was worth $3 million. So that's worth a lot more today. So in my mind, you could have said $1 billion. It would have sounded like the same. I was so broke back then. but I was just blown away that this guy was telling me like, hey, you know, I got there because I was a specialized engineer in this field. I've been feeling more and more obsolete every year that I've been working there. And like, now that I'm retired, I am obsolete. I'll never be able to earn this kind of money again. So I'm terrified to spend it. I don't know how to invest it. I don't know how to spend it. Cause like, this is it. This is my last $3 million. And it blew me away that you could be a multimillionaire and be worried about money at that time. So for me, you know, the reason I took the angle of permanent life insurance and specifically whole life insurance is I think that's one of the keys to unlock the guaranteed income. You know, a pure annuity is you trade $1 million for income that you can't outlive or whatever the number is. The problem is you give up a couple things in that process. Is you give up the legacy. There's no pile of cash left over for the next generation if you live a little while. And you also give up some liquidity, some access to capital. Not that you should be raiding your 401k for large sums of money in your retirement, you know, invading principal, you'll end up running out. But hypothetically, it feels good to be able to do that. So I look at permanent life insurance not only as a diversifier for a lot of the risks that are in retirement, but also it's shifting risk. It's putting a guarantee in place that no matter what happens with my spending or my performance in my account, my loved ones are taken care of. There is a legacy for my children. At the very least, my wife is taken care of so that she doesn't have to worry about it, so that I can, you know, then go spend or just annuitize my assets and give myself that guaranteed income stream that makes so many retirees happy. For me, it's permission to annuitize and spend my money. So it's really less about rates of return, even though they are good. And I've got, you know, all kinds of data and empirical evidence to show it actually is one of the best kept secrets in personal finance. For me, it's really about the risk shifting that a pension and you know, actuarial science provides in a way that, you know, the typical defined contribution plan does not.
Best kept secret. That was what I was curious. Do most people understand it? Do they think that all insurance is whole life?
They do, yeah. All permanent life insurance is not whole life. In fact, most of what's sold out there is universal life, because it's literally called adjustable premium flexible, you know, life insurance, which sounds great. Oh, it's flexible, it's adjustable. But those policies, generally speaking, shift the risk to the insured. They typically guarantee very little in terms of the performance of your value and solvency long term. In order for most of those plans to remain solvent long term, you have to fund it enough. The underlying, you know, crediting strategy, whether that's market based or money market based or an index based, that those all have to perform. And if they don't, or if the company chooses to change, caps or change the way that they're going to charge internally, you have to make up for all of that underperformance or lack of them following through with your own dollars. And I like whole life insurance because it completely flips that. The company assumes all of the risk. They assume all the guarantee. They guarantee cash value, guarantee death benefit. They can never raise your premium. And then with the right corporate structure, typically a mutual structure, they pay a dividend on that. So when times are not dire and they actually do have profitability and outsized performance, they give that back to you in the form of a dividend. But worst case scenario, you're good. So that's really why I focus on that kind. And I don't think many people know that distinction, especially in the marketplace, unless they're getting, good advice from the right advisor.
It's such an interesting thing. If you Google it, I bet you'll get half the results saying it's the best thing in the world and half the things saying it's the worst thing in the world. And it's really not good nor bad. It's just whole life and it does certain things. And but it's, why do you think it is such a, or do you think it is kind of a hot button product?
I think it's a hot button because there's a lot, and as with all industries and all areas of our industry, there's people that are doing it right and there are people that are doing it wrong. And I don't think it's a question of good or bad. It's more of better or worse. And people are trying to think of it, like, is there something better I can be doing with my money? And it's a foolish question to ask because who knows? What I have found and what all of the research has shown is, generally speaking, on average, unless you're very lucky, the combination of a variety of assets is what sets you up to have the maximum options no matter what happens down the road. So if all of your money is tied up in your 401k and it's invested in Nvidia stock, 15 years ago, sure, that was the best thing you could do with your money. But man, was that a high risk strategy. It could have been any number of other stocks that went to zero. So that's an extreme example, but whole life insurance, permanent life insurance, it shifts risks out of the portfolio in a way that you can't do yourself because it's spreading them out across, hundreds of thousands or millions of policy owners. And that's and you and for you, N equals one. Yeah, you get one shot at this. You don't get 10,000 simulations. You don't get law of large numbers. So actuarial science and annuities and life insurance are the way to include that in your personal plan, which is basically just privately owned pensions. I mean, a pension has a life insurance benefit. It provides spousal benefits. It has a longevity benefit. It pays you as long as you live. And the only reason a pension can do that for you is because they're spreading it across, thousands or millions of pensioners. Life insurance companies with their, boring products that the internet doesn't love because it's not the sexiest thing this week, does that for you. So that's really why I focus on it. It's for me, it's sexy. For most people, it's not. But for me, it's because it allows someone to spend the maximum amount of income in their earliest, healthiest years of retirement, when the future's not guaranteed. And I think that's the puzzle. I think that's cutting edge planning, personally. I think cutting edge financial planning is the art of helping someone spend as much as possible, as early as possible, without jeopardizing running out of money. Whereas most of the world that we live in is just, doing math problems on their calculators to try to create the biggest sum at retirement with no discussion of how it comes out and no shifting of risk. And because of that, I think people with bigger balances because they didn't buy insurance can't spend it because they're bearing all of the risks of potentially long retirements and market crashes and hyperinflation, all the things that can come into play.
It is certainly a lot. And I spent, I think everybody probably knows who listens to the show, but I'm technically a retired New York Life agent. I spent 10 years with the company and I spent 4 years with MassMutual and certainly have worked with a lot of whole life. And so much of the conversation is on the accumulation, get money in there. And then eventually you're going to be taking money out. But I imagine that there's very few agents, advisors who get to the point where they're actually helping client to take money out. So I'm curious what the biggest risks are and the biggest mistakes when people start to withdraw money from a whole life contract.
There's a lot of risks, and it's actually just not a good idea in a lot of cases, which surprises a lot of people when I say that. I started my career very early on and spent a lot of my career talking about these retirement income strategies where you build it up in the policy and then you spend it down. But there's a major assumption underlying there. And the underlying assumption is that you don't want life insurance anymore. Like you don't want to leave money to loved ones, which is absolutely not how retirees act. Even when they say those words, they still don't want to die broke. Like they don't want that to be their legacy. And when you think about a tax efficiency, what we want to be doing is there's nothing wrong with 401ks and qualified plans. We get upfront tax deductions and tax deferred growth, and it's great, but it is a tax time bomb if you don't manage it. You will eventually liquidate those assets at 40 something percent, depending on when you die and depending on what Congress is in place at the time to decide on those tax rates. That's kind of a fun thing to say is, would you ever go into business with someone where you don't know their equity percentage when you finally sell the business?
Of
They
course not.
were able to call the shots on that. That's effectively the deal you've made with a 401k or these qualified plans. The IRS can be like, you know what? You're too rich. We believe 57% is the appropriate tax rate, not 37%. So anyway, I digress. I think the issue there is getting the money out. So that's kind of why I focus on that.
And people get themselves in trouble because they take too much out, or.
So I think that what can kill these plans when you're taking money out of a whole life plan is, and really whole life is probably the best form of permanent life insurance to take income from because it's very predictable. The loan rates that you're borrowing at are typically tied to, if they're adjustable, they're typically tied to an index like the Moody's Seasoned Corporate Bond Average, which is basically the index for how the major mutuals invest their dollars. So over time, and if you look at the data, loan rates and dividend interest rates have tracked very closely together, usually within about 1% of each other as time goes by. So the point is you're borrowing against the policy at a rate that's similar to the rate at which it's growing. So even if that goes against you, where you're borrowing at rates higher than it's growing, you can see a lapse or a problem coming decades in advance if you just look. With universal life, that can happen much faster because nothing underlying is guaranteed and it's not nearly as stable. So that's how people get into trouble. It's not just taking too much. It's if in order to get all that tax-free income, you end up running up massive loans, which need to be managed. Totally fine for an accredited investor or a wealthier client with lots of other assets in other places. If it gets in trouble, we can swing a few bucks over and make sure it works. I think I wouldn't say it's predatory. It's almost like it's just uneducated advisors that are positioning a lot of this stuff sometimes. Not realizing how big the risk can be for a more average client that doesn't have all those other resources. And frankly, by the time it's a problem in their 80s, may not have the wherewithal to think through all of those issues and handle it accordingly. But, so, all that being said, I have never once in 23 years supporting advisors ever heard an advisor tell me of a story where they actually did have a client get to retirement. And systematically, over the course of 20 years, took exactly the same distribution every single year out of the policy, the way it's illustrated. The way it's normally used is they're using it as a source of capital here and there. So the market is crashing, like it's 2008. We're going to tap into our whole life policy because it just went up in value. It has to go up in value every year. So we're going to tap into that this year, or they need to, fix the roof, or take the grandkids on vacation, or fund that bucket list trip for 50 grand that they've been thinking about for their whole lives, stuff like that. That's typically how it's used. And if you think about it from a tax strategy standpoint, if it's a tax-free asset that passes income tax-free and is guaranteed to grow, it's one of the last assets that we find retirees actually want to tap into because it's their stable most their favorite most stable asset, earning 5 to 6% every year, riskless and taxless. Why would you take money out of it in that scenario? I'd rather be selling equities high and cashing in on those wins.
Well, when you put it like that, it makes sense. I remember, and I'm sure that it happens, I'm sure it's happening right now somewhere, that an insurance agent is explaining why their whole life policy is better than another firm's because of the dividend interest rate or something like that. And I never totally understood why it is that a company would try and sell based on that. And I don't know that I totally understand what the dividend interest rate really is or what that means. Can you explain that to me?
Look, the dividend interest rate is effectively the cash flow that the general investment account of the company is getting. So if a company has a few $100 billion in their general investment account, it's obviously very sophisticated and managed, and there's thousands of holdings in there. There's some equity holdings like subsidiary companies, but most of it is just fixed income, bonds, very safe assets with long durations earning, 4, 5, 6% in today's world. So when a company says they're paying a dividend interest rate of, call it 6% in today's world, they're telling you they're getting like 6% cash flow off that portfolio that they are comfortable passing through to the policy owners. So that's cash flow from the portfolio. They're not selling assets to raise that dividend. It's really quite, I'm obviously oversimplifying it, but that's roughly what it is. It's you can equate it to kind of a crediting rate on a universal life contract. It's just the math behind it is because it's all guaranteed and they don't have all those individual charges they're breaking out, you can't really see that. So that's what it is. And I think too many advisors get into this illustration warfare where one company today is paying the highest dividend, so they're going to show illustrations. And why would you go with company B when mine is illustrating to do better than theirs? And none of it's guaranteed. And when I looked at the history of all the major mutuals, they've all had their day in the sun when they had the dividend, the highest rate at the time. And most of it was serendipity. Like they just made some good investments that paid off for the next decade. And then, everything's normalizes. They all recruit their investment managers from the same Ivy League schools. So over time, they all kind of equal each other. So for me, I think that doesn't make a lot of sense. For me, there's only a handful of carriers I would buy from. And those are the carriers that are investing in, a career field force supporting that business line. They are mutually organized, so they're operating for policy owners and not, shareholders at the same time. And I think as long as those two things are true and they've got that long-term vision, then it really doesn't matter, who you're buying it from, as long as it's a highly rated carrier that's, committed to the business.
Well, that certainly makes sense. So there's a lot of variables that are important there. Obviously, the size of my portfolio is important. If I'm George Grumbach or Mutual Life Insurance Company, I have $1 trillion and I issue a 5% dividend interest, it's going to be whatever that is versus a company that's 1.5 trillion, then that's going to be more. So I guess what I'm saying is that just because a company says we're our dividend interest rate is 6%, it doesn't mean that that means a certain amount of money is going into my policy. It's not that my policy is going up by 6%.
Exactly. Yeah. 6% is like the top line number before mortality and expense. The same way in a universal life contract, if you get credited 6%, that's before, the fees and expenses come out. So some companies don't publish a rate at all on purpose just to not even have this conversation. They're also paying 5, 6%, 5 or 6%. They just don't say it because they don't want the conversation to happen. They think it can mislead clients. But in reality, if you look at a mature whole life policy, once you've gotten past those early years when a lot of those upfront expenses are taken care of, you will see a policy growing at 80 to 90% of that fully stated dividend interest rate.
Got it. And I can remember looking at a whole life illustration and selling whole life, and there's not as much cash value in the early years as there is in the later years. And I think that made certainly me was confusing early on, and it probably that can be confusing to clients. Can you just explain why that is, or just how a policy sort of works from the beginning to maybe the first 10 years and then moving forward?
Yeah, so there's acquisition costs. At the end of the day, you can forfeit these policies anytime you want. So, you think about all of the costs that a company incurs to issue these contracts. They've got underwriting staff, they've got actuaries, attorneys, marketing departments. They pay taxes on premiums to the states that they're organized under. They have their investment management divisions, like all of the things like to run a life insurance company. That's why you don't see a lot of new entrants to the life insurance world. It's a very expensive, difficult business to run. So that's just the nature of the policy is those expenses are front loaded so that the company knows that no matter how long you keep it, their acquisition cost expenses are covered. But I say that it's almost like buying a house. When you buy a house, everyone knows you don't move 2 years later and expect to have made any money after you pay realtors and movers and all the expenses that go into acquiring a home. But you know, if you can hang out there for 4 or 5 years plus, you're starting to build some equity, and now it's been a really good deal. Same thing with whole life. You know, usually by year 3 or 4 in a whole life policy, every dollar you pay in terms of premium payments, you'll see your cash values growing by equal to that amount or more. So very quickly, it's not a cost item. You've effectively paid your closing costs up front, and now you're building equity in the plan. So that's just hard for some people. You know, it's not like traditional finance where there's an account value at any given day is a fungible asset where you can just sell it. Like you can sell a stock, you can sell a bond, you can liquidate your savings account like by the minute. These are meant to be longer term propositions, and it's actually a good thing. It's actually a benefit for you as a policy owner because the company knows that they don't have to have such short term liquidity. They can take those dollars and invest in long-term corporate bonds in a way that you as an individual can't. The same way you wouldn't go to buy a 10-year CD at the bank if you might need it sooner. You typically have a shorter duration as an individual. These companies never really need liquidity. They're sitting on tens of billions, quite literally in their piggy bank, just ready to go if they needed it. But they don't because they have, you know, in one company example I can think of, they have $11 billion in new and renewal premiums coming in the door while they're paying like $4 billion in claims. You know, that's a huge positive cash flow position that they're in. So they're able to invest for the long term in a way that you and I probably couldn't. And they can do that because they don't have to give you that guaranteed short-term liquidity. So if your time horizon is 5, 10 years and beyond, that's when it really starts to become an exciting asset. And most people just don't have that kind of attention span or patience. That's frankly the if it all sounds too good to be true and you're healthy enough to get it, you know, the cost is patience. It just takes a little while to build. In fact, the IRS, I mean, people used to do this. People used to use life insurance as a tax dodge in the early 80s. They were dumping in hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in today's dollars on very small death benefits and just watching that money multiply forever and never paying income tax on any of that growth ever again. And by the way, those tax advantages still exist today. The only difference is, you know, Congress got wise to that and in 1986 implemented laws that said all that's still true, but we just have to spread premiums out. And that's why you see policies just, you know, taking a little while to get started now because they have to spread those payments out. But it all still works over a long enough time frame. So with a little runway, you know, the economics are very hard to match. That's what a lot of my studies have been on.
So I think people buy these products, these policies for a variety of reasons, obviously, because there's death benefit, you can potentially have a legacy, and it can also accumulate cash value. And that's really one of the things we're talking about and focusing on. And there is a guaranteed rate of return on the cash value, but that's not necessarily, if I put in $10,000 a year, that doesn't mean I'm getting a 3% rate of return on $10,000 because there is cost of insurance and fees and expenses. Can you walk us through how that works?
Yeah, it's not really a guaranteed rate of return. It's a guaranteed schedule of cash values. So a traditional whole life policy, regardless of the flavor you buy, and there's quite literally a million ways to design it, will typically guarantee that your cash value equals your death benefit at age 100. So if you buy a $1 million policy, then no matter how old you are, by age 100, your cash value is going to equal the death benefit. And in order to get there, it's kind of like actuarial school in 30 seconds here. What they're effectively doing is doing discounted cash flow of your money. So if I know that I need to give this guy $1 million at age 100, what do I need to collect from him every single year for a certain period of time, assuming that I can earn 4% on his money until that day, saying 4% is the guarantee rate that they use, before mortality and expense, which are also guaranteed. So that's where actuarial school gets complicated, is all the mortality charges and actuarial science that come into it. But generally speaking, that's the premise, is you know they're effectively trying to do that net of all the insurance charges that come in. So with a whole life carrier, you know, I typically wouldn't say this to a client because it might scare them off, but it's actually a good thing, is the company is on purpose overcharging. So when they sell a whole life policy, they are on purpose using worst case assumptions on their guaranteed investment rate that they're calculating. They're using worst case assumptions on mortality, like lots of people dying. Think about like a massive war breaking out, and worst case assumptions on expenses, which some of it can be regulatory or taxes or how expensive it is to administer these contracts. But over time, as the company generates profitability and the worst case doesn't happen, they give that back to you in the form of a dividend. And that's why I said mutual ownership is so important. A mutual company is owned by can be controversial, but they operate for their benefit of their policy owners. There are no other shareholders on Wall Street to give profitability to. There's nowhere else it can go at the end of the day than back to their policy owners. So that's why it's a good thing. If you've got a company that is basically putting all these guarantees in place, absorbing all of the risk, but at the same time operating for your benefit, so when they manage it well and do better than those worst case assumptions, give it back to you, the person who gave them the capital. That's a really powerful thing. The you've shifted the risk, you've guaranteed death benefits and cash value, and most of these big ones have been paying dividends since, Civil War times. It's not really a question of if you're going to get one. It's really just a question of the rate at which you get it. And once you get it, it's yours. Like once you get it, it's now your new guarantee. That's not something they can claw back, like the market that can go up and go down. So, I hope that answered your question.
No, that's perfect. Thank you. And since I was in the business, when I started, it was whole life. You paid premium till age 100, and then they created limited pay products. You pay until you're age 65. You pay for 20 years. You pay for 10 years. How did that change the math you just went through?
It doesn't really change the math. So way back in the day, no company had 10 pays or 20 pays or short pay designs. Every company just had a pay to 100 whole life. And there was ways through what's called a paid-up additions rider where you could overfund it or put additional dollars in so that you didn't have to pay as long. At some point, those dividends and performance were projected to cover your premiums moving forward. A lot of the companies, as they got bigger, just got smart about it and said, well, what if we just, from a marketing standpoint, just packaged all that into just like a nice, easy, guaranteed 10-year period of time. And those have become very popular now. So those designs tend to be very cash heavy. So it alleviates the concern of clients about the low cash values or low liquidity or low flexibility early on. Like, what if I can't pay in year two or three or don't want to? It alleviates a lot of those concerns. And the trade-off is long-term performance on death benefit. So, those paid if you really do just pay to 100 on a basic whole life, that's typically going to give you the highest, what they call internal rate of return on your money over the course of your life. Meaning, and that should be viewed positively too, because it's a permanent death benefit. It's a guaranteed delivery of future dollars somewhere down the road. And that's for me, that's the most important. Rate of return on the page is what did I actually get back over the course of my lifetime, and when you adjust those for what you'd have to earn in a taxable, risky world, it's pretty impossible to match.
Is there a best time to buy one of these? And is it ever too late to buy one of these?
Yeah, I mean, the best time is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. Yeah, that sounds like a sales pitch. I don't know. There's no best time. I think any time is fine. So I think I really do actually believe the academics, when they say like you shouldn't be buying this if you don't have enough money, or you shouldn't be buying this if you're too young. Like if you're in your 20s and all of your money is going to whole life insurance to the exclusion of everything else, you got oversold. You actually are experiencing opportunity cost. You could be doing a lot better in the market over time. And I subscribe to that. I think that's totally true. But I think it can be both. I think most prudent investors, especially as they age, are going to want some of their assets that are not completely exposed to market risk, that are still just the same in value as they were yesterday during times like the pandemic and when the market's crashing like crazy. In fact, that allows them to be opportunistic from a strategic standpoint so that during those crashes, they can be like Warren Buffett and make acquisitions of depressed value properties and things like that. So it's really age dependent. There's no wrong time to do it. I think the overselling happens to people that are, if you're managing a family of five on 100 grand of income in today's world, like you should probably buy term and invest the difference until you've got more money to be thinking about spreading it around to all these other vehicles. But as you start to have some success, this is heavily funded by some of the wealthiest Americans out there because, you can multiply your money by many times for your family and put a lot of protection in place in the meantime, without ever paying the IRS a dime. So I think the optimal, the time when you probably know best when to buy whole life insurance is probably in your 40s and 50s. You are who you are financially. You can actually imagine retirement to some degree, and what amounts you might care about, and what your family's dynamic is. But that said, I think younger folks, there's nothing wrong with owning a little bit of whole life insurance and a lot of term, and then investing the rest elsewhere.
Thank you. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Where can people learn more about you? How can they get engaged? I know that we just scratched the surface, and I know that you are one of the nation's foremost experts in this, and you do a lot of training for advisors. So, how can people connect?
Well, I would say check out permissiontospend.com. That's probably the best place. That's the title of my book, Permission to Spend. And while I do focus a lot on using whole life insurance as a way to maximize it, really my doctorate's in retirement income planning first. I have just in all my studies, I've realized that the optimal approach in retirement is a combination of the investment world and the insurance world, insurance being annuities and life insurance and long-term care, and the marriage of the two. So I think a lot of folks in our industry were either born in one or two of those places. They were either born in the insurance world or born in the investment world, and therefore, just like Eastern and Western medicine, that's kind of how they view the world. But the best advisors I've come across are actually, marrying those together. So check out permissiontospend.com. You can follow me online too, and I do a lot of talking about, how we effectively do that without, limiting our upside, and maximize our enjoyment in retirement.
Excellent. Well, if you enjoyed as much as I did, show time of your appreciation, share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Go to permissiontospend.com and pick up the new book. And this is complicated, confusing stuff. So I really appreciate you taking the time to break it down a little bit. So appreciate it. Thank you again.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Finally, friendly reminder, there's never going to be anybody more interested in your financial success than you are, so act accordingly.